From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we'll explore the continuing work of community prosecutors in Milwaukee despite lack of funding.
Later, the story behind Milwaukee Magazine's redesign and the new additional title for its editor-in-chief.
Renaissance Theater Works explores the nature of success in the 1982 play Top Girls.
I think Carol Churchill realized that for women to succeed, you have to succeed within the confines of patriarchy. So if you're succeeding in a system that's flawed, your success will be flawed.
And we'll learn why a post-apocalyptic novel was a perfect title to unite the community of Shorewood.
We wanted to involve and entice readers from Shorewood High School students to baby boomers and beyond.
Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. For nearly two decades, Milwaukee County's Community Prosecution Program has been pairing local police with the district attorney's office in order to respond to complaints from citizens. But while the program seems popular with residents, its future is in jeopardy. The federal government stopped funding the program last year.
Now, only a few community prosecution units remain in operation, at least until they spend the last of the money allotted to them in previous years. As WUWM's Marty Michelson reports, some groups are considering seeking alternative funding options to keep the program alive.
I met community prosecutor Ann Lopez at a big three-story brick house near 20th and Greenfield. She says she's following up on a homicide that happened on the property, and neighbors are concerned. They've asked her to investigate further to see if it's a nuisance property.
There are some allegations of a rooming house happening here. There may be, you know, drug issues going on. There may be other type of illegal activity happening within the residence. So.
Lopez is an assistant DA in the Milwaukee County District Attorney's Office, but her duties go beyond trying cases in the courtroom. She actually reports to work every day at the District 2 Milwaukee Police Station on the near south side. Then she goes out and investigates neighborhood complaints, such as those raised at this property. Lopez calls this type of visit a knock and talk, and she doesn't travel alone. She's part of a community prosecution unit. It consists of herself, a couple of Milwaukee police officers, and representatives of the city's Neighborhood Services Division.
Hey, can you come on down? We're city inspectors. We gotta check the building.
One of the tenants lets us in,
and we
climb up to the attic. Inspector Sue Steinbach explains what the team is looking for.
So sometimes we find people living upstairs in the attic. So we usually try to check attics, basements.
Once we get back outside, Assistant DA Lopez makes her assessment. The team didn't find anything suspicious.
It is not an illegal rooming house. It's completely legit. And not all of the units are occupied. It seems like some may have left after the homicide there. So we made contact with who we could, just making sure everything is okay.
Lopez says much of her job involves identifying and shutting down problem properties, such as drug houses. She says the program helps foster good relations between the Milwaukee police and the communities they serve.
Some people aren't comfortable calling directly to law enforcement, 911, the non-emergency number. So we serve as a liaison or as a medium for the community and law enforcement.
The community prosecution program began in Milwaukee County in 2000. It was expanded in 2007 to include a prosecutor in every police district. District Attorney John Chisholm says the community prosecutors have helped solve problems in neighborhoods on several fronts, including gangs, drug dealing, and prostitution. He says the idea behind the approach is to nip criminal activity in the bud.
It could literally be something as simple as pulling a neighborhood together, getting some resources, sometimes from the private sector, Habitat for Humanity, other places where you go in and you fix up the front porches and address the lighting issues in the neighborhood.
Yet despite the success of the program, its future is in doubt. Chisholm says federal funding for the program had been consistent for 15 years. Then it ran into a snag. In 2017, the federal government chose not to fund any of the country's community prosecution programs. Chisholm says as each unit runs out of money, it is disbanded. Then the person serving as the community prosecutor goes back to trying cases in the courtroom. That's happened to more than half of Milwaukee County's community prosecution units. There used to be one in each of the city's seven police districts. Now only three remain, including the one on the near south side. Betty Grinker says she fears a spike in criminal activity if it's forced to disband. She lives near 30th and Greenfield, where drug houses and prostitution are prevalent. Grinker says the community prosecution unit has been successful in helping to weed out problem properties.
Haven't helped the neighborhoods if we don't have and there isn't enough officers to cover all these small, they could call these small calls. They monitor the nuisance properties. They're not going to be able to do it.
Grinker is founder of Operation Impact, a nonprofit that raised money last summer to hire a private security firm to help knock out prostitution in her neighborhood. She says her group will push for money to come from other sources, such as federal block grants or state funds, in hopes of keeping the community prosecution program alive. David Laban is president of the National Group Association of Prosecuting Attorneys. He believes the program will eventually be funded.
Whether it's called community prosecution, whether it's called another program we run as high-performance prosecution, most recently some of our offices have been referring to what's called intelligence-driven prosecution. So some prosecution strategy that includes the community, I think, will be there.
Laban says he hasn't heard U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions indicate whether he supports the program. We contacted the U.S. Department of Justice but didn't get a response. Marty Michelson, 89.7 WUWM.
You can find more stories from reporter Marty Michelson at WUWM.com.
If you're a regular reader of Milwaukee Magazine, you might have noticed that the monthly publication has looked a bit different for the past couple of months. That's the result of some design changes that change the look and add to the content as well.
If you look at the masthead, that's the list of all the staff, you'll see that's a bit different as well, as Editor-in-Chief Carol Nixon has added a significant new title to her job. More on that in a moment, but first she tells Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke more about the design changes.
Well, you know, magazines, like anything else, they get stale. And it had been, I think, 3 years since our last redesign, which was a full redesign. And this is just a refresh. But so it was time to make some changes. And we had a couple of goals. First and foremost, you know, a lot of it comes down to fonts. And I think that, you know, there's a good Saturday Night Live skit in the conversations that art directors and editors can have about fonts, because, you know, until you start thinking about them and looking at them.
Right, serifs or no serifs.
Yes. I mean, but it becomes like wine tasting. It's like, I see this one as a little more casual, yet playful. And I'm like, no. I think that it is standoffish.
It's nothing worse than a standoffish font.
No, and that's what we were trying to get away from. We wanted sophisticated yet friendly. And we went with Canela. I don't know. That means nothing to anyone.
It's a lower fat font, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we have new fonts. But I don't think that your listeners will be that interested in that. what they might be more interested in is that we revamped some of the sections. So we kind of folded the culture section into a bigger section that opens the magazine and is called Navigator. And in addition to the usual cultural coverage, that will also contain some stories about city life.
And suburban life, too,
suburban
right?
Suburban life, yes, exactly. We're going to try to include the suburbs in our coverage on a more regular basis, a more regular attention to style. So be it a home tour this month, it's a tour of a boathouse that's particularly glamorous. But those are the main things that are different. So Navigator starts the magazine. It's it can be as long as 10 pages, and it encompasses a lot of aspects of city life and lifestyle.
Well, and I imagine some of the challenge here is what magazines are dealing with in general, having a design that keeps people paging through the magazine mm-hmm. for its entire shelf life, the month that it's current.
Exactly, yeah. And pacing, you know, as you bring up, is a big deal. And the front of the magazine will now have some spreads so that your eye has something a little bit more eye candy-like to linger on, and in addition to longer reads and this and that. But one of the things I'm most excited about is Insider, which used to start the magazine. It's now the second section. And Insider is our little bit more hard news section of the magazine. So we've added to the coverage that we already have run in Insider something called The Big Story. And that's sort of a deep dive into a local story that needs a little bit more analysis or just a little bit more attention.
To that end, there's also been a refresh to your title. You have been editor-in-chief for a while, but now you have added the title of publisher. And I guess what would be great is to have you talk a little bit about the role of a publisher in the context of a magazine. I mean, what do you do as the publisher versus as the editor-in-chief?
You know, it is so literally left brain, right brain. And I never forget which one's the creative and which one's the, you know, business, but whichever is which, being an editor is pretty creative. I mean, you have to be organized and you have to create a structure. But it's a creative endeavor, and being a publisher is being responsible for the business side of the magazine. And luckily, we promoted a sales rep, Natalie Blaze, to the role of sales manager, and so she shares a big portion of this job with me. But together, we are devising different revenue streams, and in the same way that as an editor, I try to be responsive to readers, as a publisher, Natalie and I work together to be responsive to advertisers and what their needs are. So that's basically the role.
The editorial side and the business side, in a lot of cases, don't always see eye to eye in places. Is it a complicated dynamic for you?
You know, that's an interesting question, because if for anyone who's worked at a newspaper or magazine or even, you know, had any sort of exposure to that, there was always the expression church and state, that editorial was supposed to be free from the pressures of the business and also free from any sort of collusion of, you know, advertisers paying for coverage. And I think that sitting in both seats or taking on this dual role makes me even more able to make sure that things are separate and in keeping with the high standards that we've always held for the magazine. That said, I also am in a good position to I think understand both sides of it in a way that someone who's just in one role doesn't.
Do you have to go from working 40 hours a week to working 80?
Yes, something akin to that.
Oh, good.
I keep thinking like next month it's going to be better, but you know, so we'll see.
Well, Carol Nixon, best of luck to you in the dual role, and congratulations on the redesign.
Thank you very much.
Carol Nixon is Milwaukee Magazine's editor-in-chief and publisher.
Coming up next, Renaissance Theater Works stages a play from 1982 that feels as relevant now as it did when it was first produced. We hear about the new production of Carol Churchill's Top Girls when Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. In the late 1960s through the 1970s, what is known as the second wave of feminism in the United States upended many societal expectations about women's roles. Women left the home to take on jobs and careers that had been closed to them before. But as is the case for many seismic cultural shifts before it, not everyone was on board with feminism's changes. And of course, no one really understood what the longer-term fallout of those changes might be.
By the time British playwright Carol Churchill wrote Top Girls in 1982, women in both the U.S. and the U.K. were beginning to question the cost of supposedly having it all. Churchill's work has always explored feminist themes, and in Top Girls, she combined that sensibility with a hard look at how women define success for ourselves.
Milwaukee's Renaissance Theater Works, a company started by women in order to give women in all aspects of theater a chance to work, is staging Top Girls. It opens later this week. I met with three of the actresses in the show at the rehearsal hall, Carissa Merle Myers, Elise Edelman, and Cassandra Bissell, along with one of the company's founders and the director of Top Girls, Susan Fate.
I think Carol Churchill realized that for women to succeed at that time and still right now, you have to succeed within the confines of patriarchy. So if you're succeeding in a system that's flawed, your success will be flawed. And the political climate of the play is shockingly similar to today. You know, they talk about Margaret Thatcher and the end of monetarism. You know, that was her plan for the economy, for Britain. And she was responsible for ending free milk in the schools. She increased the poverty rate in children over her tenure by 40%. Yep. So I think it's shockingly relevant for the United States and for the world. And the idea that resonates the most for me is, what do we owe the least of our society? How happy can we be about success and achievement when it comes on the back of the less fortunate? That's a universal message. I pray for the time when it won't be relevant, but it certainly speaks to us now.
Yeah, how do we define success? Mm-hmm. And I like that idea of it, if it's within the constructs of the society you're in, mm-hmm. then it's going to, of course, reflect
right. Whatever
that is. And so for the actors who are here, how do you feel about your parts? And you're all young enough that you weren't around probably in 1982 to see or witness, mm-hmm. you know, what this is. So how do you feel it's relevant?
At least they weren't grown.
Oh, they weren't grown up. Yeah. You were around, but not old enough to have gone to the theater.
Right.
And so how do you feel about it from where you're sitting today?
Well, it's brilliant, but its brilliance is saddening because it is still so relevant. One of the most incredible things about working on this show has been being in a room full of women, just working on a theater piece in which everybody involved is a woman, because it doesn't happen. I can't think of another play that I've been in that was all women, ever. I don't think I've ever been in an all-female cast. And I've been doing this for 20 years, so that's not nothing. And the conversations that we've been having in the room, that we've been able to have because it's a room full of women, mm-hmm. have been wonderful conversations, but also, again, sad. This play is prompting us to have all these conversations about our current experiences and how they relate still to this play all these years later.
So what kind of experiences are you relating? What kinds of conversations are you having?
This sort of cycles back to what Susan was talking a little bit about. I play Angie, who's the daughter in the play. Marlene has a line, and I might botch this, Cassie, but it's something like, anyone can make it in the free world if they have what it takes. And in the play, Marlene leaves her small town and does end up make it and becomes this high-powered lady. But my character represents the girl who doesn't have what it takes and gets left behind because she doesn't innately have what it takes.
And how about for you?
Yeah, so I think that this comes at a really, it's very timely in that, you know, we're kind of still in this hashtag Me Too, you know, campaign or movement, if you want to call it. And I think that looking at just the broad spectrum of what women have endured for so many centuries, mm-hmm. you know, because I play a woman who lives in 13th century Japan, and she talks a lot about her experiences and how she had to succeed and triumph in a time when she had very little autonomy, that was given to her, so she had to take it for herself. And there's just a wide array of characters from different historical periods, right? So they all talk about their experiences and how they had to overcome the patriarchy in different ways, in different forms, just based on what was going on at the time. And some of the stories I feel like could be told by people that I know today. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not really that different mm-hmm. from things that I've even experienced in my own life. And I think that that's kind of terrible, but also empowering that we are now able to talk about them in yes. a much more open, honest. And I think that the introduction, obviously, of today of like social media has been really helpful in getting these stories out there. So I think that it's really relevant.
We also picked it before the election. So this was already on the docket before we now know what happened with our lovely election.
Right.
And what kind of a statement right. that election makes about how not far we've right. gone.
Do you think this play is at all hopeful that this will change?
Carol Churchill is famous for not providing answers, only questions. So I like to think that there's hope in the play. I think it's also a plea for compassion. And the fact that she wrote it, and there are people that recognize we need an ethic of compassion in our world, that's hopeful.
I also think that a big thing, there's a BBC piece that was done where they interviewed a bunch of different people, and they interviewed an academic teacher and asked her the question about, is this a feminist play? And I really liked her response, because her response was very simple and very basic, and it was like, it's a feminist play simply by virtue of the fact that it is providing theatrical jobs for this many women. Just simply mm-hmm. that, mm-hmm. that mm-hmm. Renaissance has chosen this play, and it means that we have a group of this many women in the room getting to hash out these complicated right. roles that have a lot of depth to them, that are not all, they don't all fit into cookie cutter categories mm-hmm. of right. wife, mother, sister, you know, like these are really interesting, fascinating roles. And that is still a battle that we're fighting in 2018 about having access to roles and scripts. And people are writing the plays. It's a matter of whether they're getting produced. I mean, they're out there.
Right.
It's also a matter of people choosing. And so the fact that we're doing this play that was done in 1982, it's like, yes, people are writing these plays. They've been writing mm-hmm. them for ages. Right. People just aren't choosing to produce them.
Right. And not only are you getting to do it, you're getting paid to do it.
Yes.
You know, so
exactly.
it's like
worth.
It has worth in our society,
right.
which is that economic base,
right.
which she was talking about too.
Right. Absolutely.
You and I have talked a lot about what you've been trying to do over the 25 years of mm-hmm. Renaissance. Do you feel that there has been? I mean, we're talking about how things really haven't changed, but have they?
There's been some movement of the percentage of plays written by women that have been produced in the United States, but it's no. I mean, I went to the Statera conference in 2016, and they had the head of Actors Equity there. And she showed a very dismal economic future for women in theater. Women are paid less, they work less, they don't reap the benefits that men do in the same situation.
And we're talking about theater, which is notoriously not well paid to start with.
Right. But this is always so ironic to me that 70% of theater goers are women, and I think it's 80% are ticket buyers, you know? So I think we can hopefully raise enough awareness that people will start calling theaters and saying things like, why are 80% of your plays written by men? How come no one's producing Sweat by Lynn Nottage? You know, like, won the Pulitzer Prize, for God's sakes. So stuff like that.
Do you think it has something to do with the fact that, again, what we were talking about earlier, that women aren't used to having the opportunity to have the conversations with each other and also then hearing their stories, you know, that we're all taught, we're all part of the, you know, the culture that we're in, and we're all taught that men's stories are more important.
Well, not only are they more important, but we're expected to relate to them, you mm-hmm. know, like I'll watch a TV show and or a movie, and it is, you know, 90% men, And then if there are any female characters, the majority of them, they only exist as how they relate to the men. They're a mother, they're a wife, they're a girlfriend, they're the sex object, you know. And so when that is your worldview, when that is what is represented to you as your role, maybe women don't think that they're able to even have a voice at the table because they're not shown as having a voice at the table or even a place there. It's frustrating.
I think this is the first play I've ever been in, actually, that passes the Bechdel test. You know, like there's one scene where a significant other is brought up in the latter half of the play, but it's not important to the conversation, really. And I'm realizing that right now that that is true. This is the first play I've ever been in.
Wow.
That has,
yeah,
passed the Bechdel test.
We should probably say what that is for those who don't know.
So Alison Bechdel has now become famous because of the musical Fun Home, wrote a comic strip, and basically it's how long a movie or film or play or story can go between two women, a conversation between two women, how long that conversation can go without bringing up a man.
And the women have to talk to each other and have names.
Yes. wait, whoa.
Amazing.
Wait, that's revolutionary.
I know.
Yes, like, I don't know. Good thing we were sitting down for that.
I thought that it just was in order to pass the Bechdel test, there had to at least be a scene that involved two women talking to each other who were named, in which it was not about a man.
And that is so much easier than the way I just described it.
That's okay.
And it's because we never get to see it.
It's never done.
Yeah, except by Carol Churchill, apparently. One of the big key points is about women in positions of power, right? Women, more women who are in positions to be making the decisions so that programming, et cetera, that's how that comes into play. And it's just a really slow, grounds-up process getting there. There's a really wonderful book, and I'm going to forget the name of the author, but it's called Broad Influence, Broad, B-R-O-A-D, Influence, How Women Are Changing the Way America Works, or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it's she was a journalist who worked on, you know, in D.C. for many, many years, so it's 10 years worth of her interviewing various people and in government, and she really gets at analyzing how women function differently, how they form diplomatic relationships, how they converse, how they compromise, and she really makes a very strong argument, and this is particular to government and politics, though, about how much more smoothly things run when more women are at the table, and that it doesn't even have to be 50%, but that if you can break the 20% threshold, you start seeing really big differences in communication and how things get done and being more productive. So it doesn't even have to be 50%. No. It just has to be over 20.
Although it should be, because we're 51% of the population.
Right.
So, yes.
No, it should.
Absolutely, yeah. I agree. Yeah. But I'm just saying in terms of the... And I feel like I feel like the race conversation in this country, sometimes I feel like actually... Not that we've improved things, but that the conversation is louder and angrier, and that the gender thing still ends up getting shoved to a back burner. Mm-hmm. And that even I've had conversations with people where it's like, people really are shocked to be confronted with the statistics, even on things like salary discrepancy.
Mm-hmm. Is it at all frustrating for you in this to be presenting this play and think, oh my God, it really hasn't changed that much?
Yes. Yes. I am so tired of people saying things to me like, I really choose my plays on merit, not on who writes them. And I think you really need to be careful that you're not exclusive, where no one ever says to other companies where 80% of their work is written by men, why are you excluding women? Never happened. 66% of our work is written by women, historically, you know. And how can you say you're seeing the most excellent work when you only see half the canon, if that?
Well, I cannot wait to see this show. It is one of my favorite pieces of theater in the world, and I have never seen a production of it.
Oh, lovely.
So this is going to be just delightful to be able to see this whole thing, particularly after this discussion, you know, to do that. But I want to thank all of you for taking some time and break a leg.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you, Bonnie. Always delightful.
We spoke with director Susan Fate and actors Carissa Morrell Myers, Elise Edelman, and Cassandra Bissell about Renaissance Theatre Works upcoming production of Carol Churchill's play Top Girls.
The show opens this Friday at the Broadway Theatre Center in the Third Ward. There's more information at WUWM.com.
We'll take another break and then talk with two of the organizers of this year's Shoreward Reads event. Like Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR.
Always remember.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie North. The idea of community-wide or statewide or even school-wide common reads has been gaining steam in recent years. Several Milwaukee area schools and towns have organized months or year-long efforts to get as many people together to read the same book.
In Shorewood, a successful effort a few years ago with Wisconsin writer Nick Butler's Shotgun Love Songs led to another ambitious effort this year, the post-apocalyptic Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. We'll revisit our interview with her in a few minutes.
But first, Lake Effect's Mitch Teich wanted to know why this was the right book at the right time in the right place. So he asked two people involved in organizing Shorewood Reads, Emily Vieira, the assistant director of the Shorewood Public Library, and Janae Sacken, president of the Friends of the Shorewood Public Library.
We wanted to involve and entice readers from Shorewood High School students to Gen Xers, to baby boomers, and beyond.
It's a difficult task.
It is a very difficult task. Our last book by Nicholas Butler in 2015, Shotgun Love Songs, inadvertently accomplished that. And so we were trying to do that again. And I think we have done that, although I must say everyone from baby boomers and older said, an apocalyptic novel? Are you insane? And they have been the ones turning out in droves for book discussion groups and for our programming.
I think, yeah, we saw a lot in Station 11 that we thought would be especially interesting to Shorewood, too.
Why Shorewood? Why does Shorewood connect so well with Station 11?
Yeah, a lot of it takes place in and around the Great Lakes, and we are right on the lake in Shorewood, and lots of people feel a really deep connection to that. So there's a bit of that kind of environmental awareness and just awareness of our surroundings. But it's at the same time that, as Janae said, it is kind of that post-apocalyptic novel. It's also very literary and talks a lot about the role that art plays in our lives. And Shorewood is a community in which the arts is very important, whether it's making art or enjoying art of all types. And so that's a really big theme in this book, is what art means to us even after the world ends.
How familiar were the two of you with this book before it emerged as the Shorewood Reads selection?
Well, I read it when it first came out, and then one of the members of our organizing committee recommended the book, and among 35 other possible titles.
I was wondering about the process.
Yeah. And I reread it and jumped right on board, and I thought it would be a lot of fun. And I also love the metaphorical depth of this novel. It's apocalyptic and it's a pandemic. It's a flu pandemic specifically. But I think our communities and our country and our world are facing a lot of other possible pandemics, one of which is occurring in the Great Lakes. And so I thought it made a good choice for Shorewood.
Yeah. Had you read it before this?
I hadn't read it. I read it as part of our book selection process. And yeah, was kind of instantly attracted to it amongst our other contenders. Just felt like it had a lot more to offer to us. And a lot more ideas and topics that we could explore, which is something we were really committed to this time around.
As we're having this conversation, we're just a few days away from when Emily St. John Mandel actually comes to Shorewood to be a part of the Shorewood Reads series. But as you say, events have been going on for some time linked to the read. What are the kinds of things that have already happened, and what has come out of them?
Yeah, we've been having events since the end of January, so one or two events kind of every week. Everything from a game night at which participants focused on the game Pandemic.
This is an end of the world game night.
Exactly.
Yes.
Yep. End of the world game night. So that's really fun. And we already have a monthly game night for adults. So we just kind of piggybacked on that and transformed it by just focusing on Pandemic, the game that you play on a team and fight disease from spreading around the world. So kind of simulating what you could do to stop that from happening, the fictional pandemic in the book. We've explored tattoos. We've explored Shakespeare. We've explored comic books. And we've explored the Great Lakes all through programs.
And the Shorewood High School students are putting on a dramatic reading, original music creation, and light show called Shorewood 11. And then we're having a series of programs with Emily St. John Mandel when she arrives on April 10th.
Well, and so I know I've talked about this probably with you, Emily, in the past and with other communities about their community-wide reads. But I'm curious to get your take. What do you see as the effect of a community-wide read that goes beyond, you know, the book itself?
Yeah, I think some of it is just kind of about uniting people around one topic or one task of reading, one thing that they're doing. It's sort of rare that we do that, even in a really small community like Shorewood, because we're all really busy and we're all doing a million things and we all have other interests. But having this sort of one thing that everyone can happen to communicate about or share is really fascinating, and I don't know, just gives us a different way to connect with people that we might not otherwise connect with.
Another thing that this does, one of our programs on April 10th is Emily and Lauren Fox having an onstage conversation about the craft of writing, as well as Emily's personal journey to becoming a published author. And that will bring the extensive community of writers that we have here in the Milwaukee area out to listen. And given that they came out the last time for Shotgun Love Songs, and they continued talking about that for years after, I have every expectation that that is what will happen this time, that we will, all of us writers, will pick up some craft. Some insights.
Well, congratulations on this one. Job well done, and best of luck with the events that are coming up.
Thank you.
Jeanne Sacken is president of the Friends of the Shorewood Public Library. Emily Vieira is assistant director of the library. You can find more information about the Shorewood Reads program from the link at wuwm.com.
Writer Emily St. John Mandel will be in town for events linked to Shorewood Reads. We'll revisit our interview with her when Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM now. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Before the break, we learned about the community-wide read going on in Shorewood, featuring the book Station 11 by Emily St. John Mandel. The 2014 novel takes place around the Great Lakes and plays out after a flu pandemic has wiped out much of the population of the United States.
Among the survivors is a theater troupe that travels around the upper Midwest called the Traveling Symphony. The novel weaves in the fragility of life, the perseverance of art, the fleeting nature of fame, and more. Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke spoke with Emily St. John Mandel back in 2014, and she talked about what she thinks we can get as a society by thinking about the end of society as we know it.
Emily St. John Mandel, welcome to Lake Effect.
Thank you so much for having me.
What do you think we get as a society from thinking about the end of society as we know it?
I think we get a sense of what we have, these things that are so incredibly easy to take for granted. The way that, for example, somebody walked into this room this morning was probably you. Flipped a switch and the room was flooded with electric light. Or you turn the faucet and water comes out of the tap. These are extraordinary things that I think we too easily take for granted and maybe don't even see anymore. And for me, setting a novel in a post-apocalyptic landscape was to write about those things by writing about their absence. So I saw the book as a kind of requiem, I suppose, or a sort of love letter to the modern world.
Have you had experiences in your life where the tenuousness of those kinds of things, the being able to throw a light switch or the ability to access any information you want at any time you want, has been evident that it might not always be there?
I have. I grew up on a very small island on the west coast of British Columbia. It's about the same size and shape as Manhattan, with 1,000 people. And like many very rural places, the power lines were above ground. And so every time there was a winter storm, trees would fall on the lines, and we would be absolutely the last priority for the hydro company coming from Vancouver Island to make repairs. So it wasn't that unusual for power to be knocked out for 2 or 3 days at a time over the winter. And of course, in a place like that, there's no municipal water system. So in the summertime, our deep well would go dry. So we'd switch to a cistern, which pumped from a creek. And it just became incredibly convoluted, and you had to be careful how much water you used. So I think that upbringing might have given me some appreciation for how easily these things can go away.
Well, and maybe what it might look like if those things did go away.
That's true, although I'd never experienced it for more than a few days or a summer at a time. So when I was researching this book, I spent some time reading survivalist forums on the internet, which was exactly as unsettling as it sounds, but fascinating, you know, to find out the details of how people would and do live way off the grid.
There's a character in this book. Well, he starts life as, or he starts his adult life as a member of the paparazzi, but then
right.
As we meet him, he is, he's a paramedic.
Yes.
And we later come to find, and we don't want to give much away in this book, but he survives for quite some time in a very enclosed place.
He was a character who I really liked, Jeevan. He starts off, as you said, as an entertainment guy, paparazzo, tries to become an entertainment journalist, fails, wants to do something that matters as he sees it, so starts to turn more toward medicine, and he's training to be an EMT as the book opens. And following the collapse, which in this book is a flu pandemic, he does find a way to pursue his interest in medicine and in helping people in a much greater way than he had before.
The end that has happened in this book happened very quickly, which seems like it's the key to the way things have fallen apart.
It is. The end in this book is a flu pandemic with a freakishly fast incubation period, which I would imagine some scientists would quibble with me about, but it's fiction. So.
Artistic license.
Exactly, yeah. So I had an extremely virulent strain in the book that kills a lot of people very quickly. You either die or you don't. And for the ones who don't, there are still quite a lot of resources around.
But they have to adjust to this life at the drop of a hat, essentially.
Exactly. This life after electricity, after everything we take for granted.
Well, so given these things that were percolating in your mind as you dreamed up this novel, where does the Traveling Symphony fit in?
The Traveling Symphony takes to the road, I suppose it's about 5 years after the collapse, and the book catches up with them around year 20. And my idea with this symphony was that presumably in the moments immediately following a societal collapse, it would all be blood and chaos and mayhem, which I didn't find that interesting to write about. That ground's been covered very thoroughly by novelists before me. What I did find interesting was to consider what the world might look like 15, 20 years out, because mayhem is not a sustainable way of life for years and then decades. I think eventually we would be trying to figure out how to live peaceably with one another. And I had an idea that at that point, one of the burdens that survivors might carry would be memory. You know, of course, we think of remembering as being a good thing, and in most ways it is. But what a burden memory might be if you were having a hard time living in this new world. So I wanted to write about a group of people living together, and the symphony was a way of doing that. And I also thought that there might be a moment 15 or 20 years out when people might again be interested in things like music and theater and the things that make civilization civilization.
And there's also interesting parallel that goes on, because one of the things that the Traveling Symphony does, and it's not just a symphony, it puts on plays, is they put on Shakespeare. And Shakespeare, of course, has his own life marked by plague.
That's exactly it. Originally, in the early drafts, I had the symphony performing plays from a whole range of eras, from Shakespeare to David Mamet to modern teleplays, which might have been kind of funny, but there was something a little incongruous about performing episodes of Seinfeld in the post-apocalyptic landscape.
As delicious as that idea
exactly,
is.
Exactly, yeah. It started to seem somewhat insufficient. So I started narrowing it down to a repertoire that was before the age of electricity. And then as I read more about Shakespeare and his life, I began to see some interesting parallels, as you alluded to. The most obvious being that in his time, theater would very often have been a matter of these small companies of traveling players moving from town to town. And also, as you mentioned, his life was so heavily marked by plague that it touched him personally. He lost several siblings. And it began to seem to me that the people in Shakespeare's era, which was Elizabethan England, dealing with these waves of bubonic plague sweeping again and again every few years over the landscape, that they would probably be people who are somewhat haunted by their memories of recent pandemics, which was an interesting parallel to the book I was writing.
And in the middle of all this is the character Arthur, who is one of a handful of characters and obviously the central character that doesn't make it into the post-flu era.
That's true. He dies in the first chapter, which is the night before the flu reaches Toronto, where he's performing King Lear.
But it strikes me that the kinds of stuff that the people who are living even 20 years after the flu hits are the kinds of things that he was already dealing with as he was about to meet his own demise.
That's interesting. Right. I mean, these are both before and after the flu, actors who are grappling with what it means to devote your life to acting, to devote your life to art, the joys and the costs of that. And I found it interesting to carry that thread through from a time that's more or less the present day to an unrecognizable world.
Those of us who maybe did not necessarily see that particular episode come later to find out that that this line that it carries, the lead caravan carries with it, was taken from a Star Trek Voyager episode.
It was. It was an episode that aired, rather, in 1999 that had the line in it, survival is insufficient. And it struck me as a very elegant expression of something I believe to be true.
Well, and there is something actually Star Trek-like in what this symphony is doing. They're exploring worlds that at one point were known, but going out often into uncharted territory.
That is true. These are new frontiers. I hadn't thought of it in those terms, but that's right.
We should say a little bit more about Kirsten,
sure.
Who is this actress and who is at the center of a lot of what takes place in this book. And she is in the strange sort of situation of having been young enough, and we find out fairly early on that she was one of the child actors who was with Arthur when he dies on stage at the beginning of the book. She is young enough not really to remember much about the pre-flu world.
That's right. It's a little bit dreamlike to her. At the beginning of the book, as you mentioned, there's a production of King Lear that features the addition of three child actresses in non-speaking roles. So she's there when Arthur dies. She sees the end of the world. We meet up with her again 20 years later. And she's somewhat haunted by these vague memories she has. You know, she remembers, for example, that fridges were cold when you opened the doors, but did they also have light inside, or is that just her imagination? These details that would slip away from you over time.
And there's some, I guess, existential discussion about whether it's important to remember what life was like before or only important to remember what's happened since and concentrate on where things are going now.
That's right. It was something that I found interesting to think about and write about, which would be that 20 years after something like this had happened in a completely altered world, would it actually make sense to tell your kids about what life had been, or would that just be incredibly depressing and or completely abstract to them?
Well, and it's hard to read this book and then watch stories about the Ebola outbreak in Africa and the conflict in Ukraine.
Yeah.
And maybe the book seems like a blueprint for our worst fears.
You know, it's interesting. People bring that up a lot at events. And what I find myself thinking about is that there must have been many points in human history, if not every point in human history, where we've felt that things are as bad as they've been and we're just on the brink of disaster. You know, I think about how terrifying it must have been at points during the First and the Second World War, or take 1968 in this country, the riots on the streets, the assassinations, the continued carnage of Vietnam. So it's as though the world's always ending, or at least we always think that way.
History is this crest of a wave, and we don't necessarily see the troughs on either side.
Yes, exactly. It's a good way of putting it.
Well, at the end of the day, when you read this, and you know, again, we don't want to give away the twists and turns that happen, but do you feel like you came out of the process with maybe more hope?
I think that's fair to say. I definitely wrote a hopeful novel, or at least I saw it that way. I've met a couple of readers who disagreed with me on that. But it was very important to me to not write a horror novel, just because that wasn't very interesting to me. And it seemed to me, as I was thinking through this book and then when I wrote it, that even if we lost everything that we take for granted, if all the trappings of civilization were to fall away, I think we would be left with everything that matters. You know, family, friendship, love, these things that would hopefully survive.
Emily St. John Mandel speaking with Lake Effect's Mitch Tyke in 2014 about her novel, Station 11. The book is this year's Shorewood Reads selection, and she will be in town for events linked to it, including next Tuesday at the Shorewood Public Library. There's a link to more information at wuwm.com. And that's today's edition of the show. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Bonnie Knorr. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Stay tuned. Fresh air is next. No, 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 no.